following presentation, one standard to rule them all, using ISO IEC 27001 to manage your compliance with other information security standards, was given by Bridget Kenyon of UCL at Network Shop 42 in April 2014.
Helpful hints and tips on the One Ring, otherwise known as ISO 27001, and how you can use it to pull your compliance efforts together for other standards. If you've got any questions or feel a sudden urge to heckle, please put your hand up and we can answer questions through the session. Failing that, there is a reminder for me to ask people for their questions or feedback at the end. Right, so what am I going to be talking about? Right, well, four things. Firstly, what's the problem? I think we're all here today, we've got some idea of the issues, but it's just from my perspective what the problem is, and just a bit of a definition, really. Then, okay, given the problem, why add to it? You could argue that adding 27001 is actually going to make matters worse. So this is a bit of context and idea of how it actually could improve things. Then a mini case study. We've been working with 27001 in and the information governance toolkit at UCL for the last few months at least. A bit of information on how it worked for us, some gotchas, and then finally some general hints and tips coming out of that experience and of the experience I've had of other organisations going through 27001 and PCI DSS and other such things. Okay. Right, firstly, what's the problem? I think if you look at that screen, you've got a vague idea of where we're going, frankly. There's one hell of a lot of stuff out there. We've got a lot of standards. I've just put down the six that I am fairly aware of. There are many others. Firstly, who here has had to deal with all of those six? We could have a show of hands. Okay. Who here has had to deal with at least one? How about two? Three? Four. Okay, so the watershed is really somewhere around three or four. So we're talking about at least two, usually three or four. PCI DSS, card data. IG toolkit. Identifiable patient data, where the patient hasn't had a say in whether it's being used. Data Protection Act, I think everybody's had fun with that in one way or another over the years. RIPA, yep, Regulation of Investigatory Powers, 2008? I can never remember what date. 2000, that's it, thank you. And our good friend from America, Sarbanes-Oxley. And finally, a new entry to the field, which is the UK government's cyber hygiene profile, which, and not to spoil anything, has repeated references to 27001, which basically says if you're already doing 27001, you're probably in a good place if you get the cyber hygiene profile pushed at you. Okay, so what's our other second problem? We do not have the time. I mean, look at that clock. Oh, it's a clock, yeah. It's got one hell of a lot of detail, and it's not very clear. Imagine, it's almost like several clocks on top of each other. And that's what we've got to deal with, a whole load of separate standards all running on their own timescales. And each of them kind of makes sense. You put them all together. Imagine the cogs and the wheels and the gears behind that. That's what we're trying to create. And a rather unfortunate focus, potentially at the management level and potentially even at the technical level, on just being compliant, on ticking boxes. And there's a reason I've put more than one list there. It's to emphasise the fact we're not just talking about ticking one set of boxes. We're talking about ticking a whole load of different boxes where sometimes the captions are almost identical and sometimes they're very different. Reconciling all that is a bit of a nightmare. So, given that, why the hell would you add something else to it? Why add 27001? Well, in order to answer that, let's take a step back. What do we want, other than winning the lottery and infinite marshmallows? One thing we do want is, as an organisation, protection from risk. if you talk to anyone in information security and a lot of places in IT, and parts of the business are becoming more and more aware of this, risk is a thing and people want to avoid it or they want to manage it. And then the really big one for, oddly enough, it's not just universities, most organisations, you threaten their reputation, you threaten their livelihood. So it's something that matters a lot because reputation, under the skin, reputation is money. And finally, the ability to support business activities. That's kind of the positive side of information risk management or information security. If you can support business activities, you're pretty well away to getting where you need to go. And you can start selling yourself as a business enabler. That's a useful tip for information security generally. So those are the three things you want as an organisation. OK, that's what you want, but what do you actually need to make this happen? Now, my argument is what you need is structure, something to hold it together, something to put it all in context, and something that is going to be there and be stable and generally recognised over a long period of time. Now, 27001 fits into that category really, really well. It gives you a number of things. To start with, it is a framework. It is designed to manage external requirements for information security and combine those with a way to put the local risk appetite, the stuff that your organisation is worried about for its own purposes, not just the stuff that that's been pushed on it from outside. There are things you actually don't want to happen because you want to protect your reputation, not just because PCI-DSS says so. And it's a fantastic blueprint for decisions about handling risk. It is not a set of decisions made for you. It is a set of questions that you then answer. But once you've answered those questions and once you've handled the business processes, you're in a very good way to actually pull together all the external and internal requirements for security. Business processes? Yeah. It is a business process standard. I mean, ISMS is what you create out of 27001. An information security management system. It's not technical. Okay, yeah, Annex A in the back of the standard. It's got a ton of stuff about, you know, authentication information and network structures and what have you. That's not the main part of the standard. That's not what you certify to. That's a whole set of controls you can choose to apply or not apply as you see fit. But the main part of the standard is around about 9 pages long, has 10 bits in it, and is very, very simple and very high level. But it is useful. Right. I shall tell my system to stop telling me useful things about April Fool's drinks. It's finding things out for me. Excuse me a moment. Better. Much better. Right. Okay, so we have a framework with instructions. It is very high level. So, what do we get as a bonus? Our added bonus is that this thing is global. Universities, one of our big things these days is globalisation, dealing with people outside the UK, outside the EU. So if you talk to them about the Data Protection Act or the Information Governance Toolkit or whatever, or RIPA, or even sometimes SOX, they'll go, what the hell are you talking about? This standard, ironically like PCI-DSS, is global. And it is more recognised than PCI-DSS at this time. So if you're compliant with this, people across the planet are going to say, well, this person is taking a reasonable level of care with security and information risk, if you choose to put it that way. Right, so with 27001, you don't just get a structure for managing requirements and defining business processes, which is in and of itself quite useful. You also get a process to maintain and continuously improve what you're doing. A kind of wraparound. That I see that as the one ring. And that expands to fit whatever standards you want to fit into it and whatever environment sensibly makes it into your scope. I shall say more about scope later because it's quite an interesting thing. So, indicators. In terms specifically of an organisation like a university, I mean, the sort of official line is 27001 is suitable for any organisation of any size. But what's the tipping point? What's the point at which you say, actually, yeah, we do need to look at 27001, or it's going to be worth our while? So, indicators. Are you handling more than one standard that relates to information security? I think the majority of people here are. Do those standards relate to information security? Yes. In fact, things like quality also link in nicely to 27001 now, because they all draw from the same template. Do you have formal reporting requirements? Is someone leaning over your shoulder saying, prove that you're doing what you say you're doing? And do you have a sensible scope? Scope is one of the hardest things to manage. I mean, if you talk about things like project scope and scope proof in a project, information security has a very similar concept for, well, for 27001. What you do and not do not want to make secure. You have to have a logical boundary, and you have to have a physical boundary, and you have to have an organisational boundary. And you have to be able to defend that and say, everything in here we're going to secure, and everything outside here we're going to manage as third parties. And you can do that even within an organisation. Very few organisations are 27001 compliant through and through. BT has about 7 little parts of itself, each of which has its own certification to 27001, as an example. And finally, unfortunately, 27001 is not going to get you top-level buy-in. You really need some level of top-level buy-in to go there, because this is about improving your business processes. It's about changing business process. So it's if you start from some level of top-level understanding that there is a risk that needs to be managed, and you say, well, let's look at 27001 to coordinate our activities, you can go further from there. Right. Okay, that was generic stuff. Let's talk about exactly what UCL did. UCL, for the purposes of this presentation, is going to be an oblong, within which we are going to put two things. Firstly, EpiLab. Now, this is an area within the organisation which is very well bounded. It's a set of research projects, basically, being run by a segment of the organisation. And that was 27001 compliant. We had another section. This is called the IDHS environment, which it's got several different names now, but we'll call it IDHS for the purposes of this presentation. And that was IG Toolkit compliant. The requirement was actually to move to a position where EpiLab was IG Toolkit compliant, because it was handling identifiable patient data, so it really had to go there. And also to move towards 27001 compliance for the IDHS environment, largely for the reason that we wanted to make sure that we could be more acceptable to external parties outside the UK. We could sell ourselves globally with regard to an environment that was handling data very securely. So it was to make sure that we didn't just have the NHS as being happy to put data in that environment. It's a physical environment, and it was a set of business processes, but it was only about IG Toolkit. So we made a fairly interesting decision. We chose to keep those two environments separate for the time being, oddly enough, much like BT that I referenced earlier. And that was for two reasons. Firstly, the two projects were operating on completely different timescales. EpiLab wanted to get IG Toolkit certified way before the IDHS environment was going to be 27001 certified, and the EpiLab didn't want to lose its 27001 certification. And secondly, EpiLab was certified against the 2005 version of the standard, and the IDHS project wanted to move towards the 2013 version. In the future, we're going to be doing that. We're going to actually be migrating the EpiLab environment inside the IG Toolkit environment. So we'll actually be reducing the amount of technical gubbins involved. So at the moment, interestingly, EpiLab actually outsources the storage and management of its data to a third party, which is also 27001 compliant. So we'll be losing the relationship with the third party and actually bringing that in-house. At the moment, that's the plan. It may change. So what was our approach to adopting 27001? Unfortunately, I'm going to have to take this fairly quickly because I've got, 25, 30 minutes, and I don't want to spend about the next 4 hours, which we could do. I could give you lots of interesting screenshots from our meetings. That's one thing we did do, is one hell of a lot of meetings, and we're still doing them. The project manager, she basically sort of throws meeting invites at me like confetti. But it's working, that's the good thing. So because we already had an IDHS project, which was all about information governance toolkit compliance, we actually tacked on the 27,001 work as a continuation of that project. I think it's phase three or phase four or something like that. And that meant that we could get budget for it, which was cool. We chose to bring on an external consultant who had brought other organisations through to compliance. And that was a very good decision. It means that we know what the interpretation is likely to be that the auditors will place on certain parts of the standard. And we know how to get from where we are to where we need to be, because he's seen that before and he's brought other people through that process. And finally, the project chose to collaborate with Central Information Security, which would be me and my team. And what we've got is a management structure such that the person running the IG Toolkit environment, so IDHS environment, has a dotted line reporting to information security and a solid line reporting to the medical school. Also, I and my team are actually acting as internal audit to that environment. We ran our first internal audit last week, which was very illuminating in a good way. And finally, we chose, you know, with risk assessments, you can end up with a list of risks about 5 pages long. In fact, you can download lists of risks 5 pages long from the internet with all the subcategories you could possibly imagine. The suggestion the auditor made, made was actually to simplify this dramatically. And we now have a standard list of 11 risks, and if people want me to send them a copy, let me know. Simplified matters dramatically, I will say. So, what's the progress? You can probably guess from the sort of fuzzy background of this slide that things are going in a fairly good direction, either that or they're exploding. Epilab took 3 months to go from 27,001 compliance to 27,001 and IG Toolkit compliance. The majority of that was simply just making sure that some of the terminology was consistent and registering to get onto the IG Toolkit website, which can take up to 18 months for some organisations. That's another story. And we're online for an audit against 27,001 in the IDHS environment in May. And that's still on track, having done the internal audit last week. So I know what the state of play is on that. So it's all good. Okay, what have we learned so far? I'm going to do lessons learned, and then I'm going to go on to tips and hints. So it's kind of half and half, if you like. Right, so yeah, the scope. The scope was really interesting. We had a technical environment, which was the IDHS environment, and we had people using it. Those were principal investigators that were running research projects that needed to get NHS data. Fair enough, so you can say that the PIs are part of our scope and the technical environment is part of our scope, and it's got a firewall around it, it's got its own authentication, it's got two-factor, it's great and lovely. And then there was a slight problem, which was that a number of other research groups across the organisation, so outside the School of Life and Medical Sciences, said, well, actually, we've got some data. The geography department is handling data from the Office of National Statistics. And they said, well, actually, we've got a whole load of data to which the same level of concern applies. Can we use your system? And the decision was taken, it makes sense for them to use it. But at the same time, because it's not NHS data, the IG Toolkit doesn't apply. So we won't be requiring them to do certain things. So what does that mean for 27,001 scope? Are these people inside scope or outside scope? So we had a very long discussion about this. In fact, we had 3 long discussions. And it was decided that they would be considered to be customers of the environment. So the customer doesn't necessarily have to be part of your scope. You're providing them with a service, and you treat them potentially as a source of risk. You control what they do via policies, via sort of due diligence, but you don't go into their environment and ask how they're operating locally. With the IG Toolkit, that's exactly what you do. So one of the things you have to do is a workplace assessment. Even if they don't hold any data locally, you have to go over to their office and say, well, I notice you're sharing this office with a completely different area, and in the corner, you happen to have a load of cupboards, and those cupboards contain all the gubbins for the building management system. And people are walking in and out just to, you know, turn on boilers and stuff all the time, and that is an actual example. And that has to be handled. Whereas with the geography department, we're not going over there and saying, oh, by the way, did you know you leave your door open when you go for a cup of tea? So you have to manage risks in a different way for different clients, and you have to decide whether or not they're in or outside scope. Authentication is rather important to work out where your scope ends as well, because if your authentication system is outside scope and yet the things you're authenticating are in scope, you're going to have rather a big piece of work to try and explain how that can work. In practice, I think it would be better to say, okay, the authentication system is in scope, if what's being authenticated also counts. Anyway, so scope is a sort of never-ending struggle, but as long as you have maybe a page worth of description of what your scope is or less, if you can say what your scope is in one sentence, then you're winning. Side effect of doing this is that, okay, we had to start off with some level of top-level buy-in, but we found that that increased as time went on. Because it wasn't just about comply with the toolkit, it was about let's talk about our risks, let's talk about what the university cares about and what the university wants to protect. And that pushed things up a bit higher into the consciousness of really senior management, because they weren't just saying, oh, we're ticking this box. We're saying, this is why we're ticking this box, this is how we're protecting ourselves, this is the level of risk we're comfortable with. It's useful. And there was quite a lot of pulling everything together. A lot of sort of paperwork and due diligence. A lot of the meetings have been about reconciling what's already happening in the IG toolkit with what 27001 is asking us to demonstrate. Because quite often we were already doing it, we just hadn't realised that. So, for example, it asks for governance. It asks for, quote, top management to do certain things and to direct certain things. That was already happening. We just hadn't defined top management. That was also a fun thing. Working out who top management was, not for the organisation as a whole, not for UCL as a whole, but for the part of the organisation that was going to be in scope for the certification. So we have kind of what we call the organisation, which is actually the IDHS project environment and the governance group for that environment. And we say top management is that those people. One of them conveniently is on the senior management team for the university, so we've got both sides covered. Policies, we'd mostly done those, because IG Toolkit's all about the policies. We found that a couple of bits, for example, incident management, there wasn't quite as much detail as we needed, so we had to add that in. Training, again, IDHS is very big on the training, so that was mostly done, but then we had to ask the question of, the people in geography, are we training them at all? Because they're not part of the IDHS environment, they're not handling patient data, they're handling statistical data. But it's still going into the environment and they're still using that environment, so there's some level of information we have to give them about what they should and shouldn't be doing. And the responsibilities of the principal investigators as well for keeping track of all of their people. Controls, most of the security measures or controls were already in place, but we did need a risk assessment, because it's all very well having a list of security measures you're putting in, but 27001 requires you to justify them, say why they're there, or why you've chosen not to implement something in Annex A. And the reason you do that is to manage a risk, not, oh, because IG Toolkit told us to. So you can't use a box ticking as a justification for doing something applying a control. You have to actually think about why IG Toolkit is asking you to, for example, have two-factor authentication for external access. And say, what is the risk that we're actually controlling with that measure, that security control? That actually made us think about why we were doing things in a bit more detail. That was really, really helpful. But it was a joining up the dots exercise rather than a start from nothing exercise, because we had this standard list of risks. So we just had to connect that up to the controls we already had. And occasionally we'd find a control that was missing and have to add one in. Right, so that's the lessons learned so far. Tips, hints and tips. Okay, first things I'd suggest to everybody who hasn't already done it is get some training in this. Who here has read 27001? Yeah. Put it this way, you can read it through, and unless you've got a specific thing you're planning on doing with it, it's going to go in one eye and out the other, if you like. It's much better to have it presented by a sort of living individual who cares a bit about it. It's more likely to stick. And it's useful to have a use case in mind while you're learning about it as well. As with all things, if you learn about it and then don't use it, it's going to go rusty. Consider professional assistance. Yes, in some cases you will need professional help. If somebody's been there before, they can help you avoid all the obvious gotchas. It's really, really useful. And it massively speeded up our process. Agree a scope. Decide what is in scope, what is out of scope. Make that one of your first decisions. Because until you decide that, you cannot actually identify what your risks are or what your security measures are at all. And have a gap analysis. Work out what your standards are asking for that you already have to comply with. And if there's anything in 27001 you're not already doing, I shall come back to that later. Retrofit controls. When you're doing your risk assessment, you're going to find some things that you realise you have to do that you weren't already being forced to do. Things that you decide, yes, this is important, we need to add it. For example, keeping track of people when they leave so you don't have leftover user accounts. Or when they change jobs, making sure that you've changed their permissions so that they've got just what they need for their current job. Those are the sort of things that you won't necessarily find in IG Toolkit. It's there implicitly. But 27001 makes you think, hang on a minute, we actually need to check that we're doing this and work out how we're going to do it in a way that we can rely on. Paperwork. Quick hint for 27001, yes, and the 2013 version. The 2005 version was very much about thousands and thousands and thousands of documents to show that you were doing what you said you would. Policies and records of doing things. 2013 version has tried to move away from that so that if you can show that you're doing something, perhaps by introducing a random member of the of your customer group and having them demonstrate that they've received the training and they understand it. You may not need to sit there and look at the training record of everyone. If you can bring sort of living human beings in and they can genuinely spout off the relevant bits of the policy, that's actually a far more powerful way of demonstrating that they've been trained. Right. Internal audit. We did the internal audit last week, and one thing we picked out that was really important is don't go through the whole damn standard all at once, because everybody will die. You're much better off doing it in little bits. Pick a couple of clauses that you fancy or that you're worried about, do those. Leave it a couple of months, do the next two. And finally, external audit is a constructive process, which is to say, having done the lead auditor course, the one thing they really drum into you is that you're looking for evidence of conformance, evidence of compliance. You're not out there to pick holes in things. You're looking to help the organisation to demonstrate that it complies. It helps that the organisation itself is paying you to do the audit. And most importantly, and this is the one thing that I think having the third party and the consultant in to help us really explained to us, you actually already have an ISMS. You have a number of things you are doing to protect yourselves. You have, for example, a firewall. You have user accounts. There's a whole load of things you're already doing. You have some policies. All that 27001 is asking you to do is to develop what you're already doing a bit further to meet a sort of minimum level of pulling everything together, of setting it up, maintaining it, and improving it. So you're looking to build on what you have. You're not looking to start from scratch. No one here has no ISMS. So don't ignore what people are doing already. And very, very last slide. Should you certify? Now, up until about 3 months ago, I was going with the theory of, well, if you can show conformance, then that's good enough because you're doing everything you're supposed to do. And then we actually started working on compliance. And we it makes you open all of those little cans of worms that you were going to deal with later that you knew about and weren't too much bothered about, and actually fix them. You get a lot much, you get genuine due diligence and you get rigor because you know somebody's going to go and check it. It's like marking your own homework versus having someone else mark it for you. Even with the best will in the world, you may cut corners, you may think, well, I know we're doing that more or less right, so I can check that box. Somebody else comes to you and says, okay, well, show that you're doing that right. You'll go and check, and you might find that what you thought was happening wasn't. Really, really valuable. I can't emphasise that enough. Right. And finally, thank you very much indeed for listening. And are there any questions?
Questions for
Bridget?
Yes.
Just for Bridget. Hang on, let's get a microphone up there quickly.
Hang on a sec, it's being recorded, so they're not going to get what you're saying. That's assuming that. Ah, there we go.
Hi, Bridget. You mentioned you and your team.
How many members of staff have you actually got working in information security in UCL?
Ah, there's two answers to that. One answer is that the information security group has about, on and off, around about 4 or 5 members. The other answer is that every single person in the university is working in information security. It's just some of them don't know it yet.
Okay, I'm going to stop us there and move us on because we had to start like with some delays. So can I just ask you all to thank Bridget?
This recording was brought to you by Janet Training as part of NetWorkshop Online. Further information is available on our website at www.ja.net/training.